Chapter 13. The Inca. Circa 1200 to 1533. The Andes Mountains are the longest continental mountain range in the world. They stretch more than 7,000 kilometers across South America from north to south, about a sixth of the way around the circumference of the Earth. These are also the world's tallest mountains outside of the Himalayas, with the highest peaks towering up to nearly 6,700 meters, or 22,000 feet, roughly two-thirds the cruising altitude of an airliner. Since their formation 6 to 10 million years ago, this geological rampart has had a dramatic effect on the circulation of the Earth's atmosphere, giving rise to some of the planet's most extreme landscapes. To the east, they act as a wall to the continent's rain clouds, pooling and gathering them, resulting in the vast jungle rainforest of the Amazon. But the land on the Pacific side of the mountains couldn't be more different. In fact, the desert that has formed there, known as the Atacama, is one of the driest places on Earth. Some weather stations set up there in modern times have never detected any rain. Still, across this desert, about 40 rivers do flow down from the mountains, forming rich oases, and for at least the last 10,000 years, humans have made their home here. Many common plants, including avocados, peanuts, and pineapples, were domesticated and farmed in these valleys, which receive virtually no rainfall. In these desert lands, several early societies rose up, like the Moche and the Nazca. But it's in the mountains themselves that the greatest civilization of South America would emerge. The Andes Mountains are among the most hostile environments on Earth. Among their high, craggy peaks of sandstone, limestone, and granite, less than 2% of the land is suitable for growing food. Even at the bottom of the valleys, it's rare to find any fertile soil. The mountains above about 4,800 meters are capped with snow and ice all year round, and the snows creep much lower in the winter months. Their narrow gorges are home to quick-flowing rivers and can only be crossed at certain points where it's possible to build bridges. For this reason, many of the early myths of the Andean peoples relate the journeys of migratory groups looking for a suitable place to live. In the Inca conception of their own history, their story began with a small band of highlanders who migrated to a place called Cusco, a warm valley in the highlands of southern Peru, likely around 1200 CE. This valley is around 40 kilometers long, fertile and watered by the Huatanay River, and it's easy to see why these weary travelers would have stopped there. Their mythical leader, Manco Capac, is supposed to have led them there using the guidance of a golden staff and the advice of the sun. The Inca creation myth, recorded in the 16th century by the chronicler Juan de Betanzos, describes the scenes that these first migrants would have seen upon their arrival. In the place which is called today the great city of Cusco, there was a small town of about 30 small, humble straw houses. The rest of the area around this town was a marsh of sedge with sharp-edged leaves. Tradition holds that these people had come from a place called Tiwanaku. Tiwanaku was a grand city, founded around 100 CE on the shore of Lake Titicaca, to the south of Cusco, in what is now western Bolivia. In the city of Tiwanaku, the art of Andean stone carving reached its earliest heights. In fact, it's here that the Inca creator god Viracocha is supposed to have carved humanity out of the very stone of the mountain itself. During this time of total night, they say that a lord emerged from a lake in this land of Peru, goes the Inca creation myth. He went from there to a place near the lake where today there is a town called Tiwanaku. There they say that he suddenly made the sun and day, and ordered the sun to follow the course that it follows. He made some people from stone as a kind of model of those that he would produce later, together with a chieftain to govern and rule over them, and many women, some pregnant and others delivered. Wandering the stone-littered landscape of Tiwanaku today, where pieces of carved volcanic andesite still litter the ground, and cracked statues of human and animal faces peer out of the walls, it's not hard to see where the Inca got this idea. The city went into decline and suffered a dramatic depopulation around the year 1000, and any Inca who visited it in the centuries that followed would have found it a ruin, which to them must have felt like the abandoned workshop of a great mason who had only just put down his hammer. The Inca were also heavily influenced by a people known as the Wari. The Wari were a desert culture, but between the year 540 and 650, while Europe reeled from the collapse of the Roman Empire in the west, the Wari expanded across the hostile mountains of the Andes. Their buildings were not as refined as those of Tiwanaku, often built of rough, uncut field stones, using mud for mortar. But this unfussiness allowed them to build on a much larger scale. Their city walls were often as much as 12 meters or 4 stories high, and their aqueducts could run for as far as 40 kilometers across the landscape. The Wari were experts at water control and marshaled enormous work gangs to build reservoirs and channels that cut through the dry coastal plains and transformed the landscape of the low Andes. They also developed ingenious terraces for growing food, designed to hold fertile soil and absorb and disperse the heat of the sun. On these terraces, lowland crops like tomatoes, squashes and pumpkins, even types of tobacco, were grown for the first time in the high Andes. The compendium of indigenous knowledge, known as the Huarochirí manuscript, remembers the Wari somewhat uncharitably. In very ancient times, when a great number of people had filled the land, they lived really miserably, scratching and digging the rock faces and ledges to make terraced fields. But the Wari were successful. Their empire was centralized and organized, with trade routes that extended throughout the mountains and allowed coca leaves, tobacco, and bright feathers to pass west out of the jungle, while maize, seashells, and dried fish passed east from the coast. But for reasons we can never entirely know, around the year 1000, this early empire rapidly came apart. By the year 1100, all of the major Wari centers were abandoned and never reoccupied. The city of Cusco found itself at the location where the influence of Tiwanaku and the Wari overlap, and so it inherited something of a hybrid culture, benefiting from both predecessors' achievements. The Wari had introduced the idea of an empire that would unite the territories of the Andes, but with their collapse, what followed was centuries of fragmentation and warfare in the mountains, as rival states competed to fill the power vacuum. From these wars, the Inca would rise. They would model themselves both culturally and politically on the Wari, even dressing their nobles in woven tunics descended from Wari traditional dress. They built their imperial capital at Cusco and modeled it after the Wari cities. All of this was designed to send a message to the people living among the high mountain passes. The days of chaos were coming to an end. The heirs of the old empire had arrived to bring order once more, and these heirs were the people of the Inca. The Inca would soon embark on a rapid expansion that would see them grow to become the greatest empire ever seen in South America, in what may have been as little as 50 to 80 years. According to tradition, this would be thanks to one great king, a conqueror of unmatched skill and energy, a kind of Andean Alexander. His name means he who overturns space and time. Pachacuti Inca Yupanqui. Pachacuti was born in Cusco, in the palace of Cusicancha. As he grew up, he would have looked out over the hills as the sun washed the grassy valley sides and watched birds fly over the yellow thatched rooftops of the city. As a boy, it's recorded that he learned history, laws, and language from his teacher, Mikyu Mana, and in later life he would become revered as a poet. Pachacuti was not intended for the throne. That was reserved for his older brother, Urco. But sometime in the early 15th century, a people known as the Chanca invaded the lands of Cusco. Pachacuti's father, the king, fled, along with the crown prince Urco, believing the city to be lost. Pachacuti stayed behind and, according to the story, rallied the disheartened Inca soldiers around him before leading them against the invaders. It's said that Pachacuti fought so fiercely, even the stones of the mountains rose up to fight the invaders, and he was given the title the Earth Shaker. Reading between the lines, it's possible that the Chanca army may have been caught up in one of the frequent earthquakes and landslides that rock this region. Whatever the cause, Pachacuti's victory was so celebrated that, around 1438, his father had little choice but to name him his successor. From the moment he became king, Pachacuti embarked on a series of grand construction projects, rebuilding Cusco after the war with the Chanca, and turning it into a city that would be the envy of the entire region. Meanwhile, he led the Inca army in a series of victories that stretched their land even further. Part of Pachacuti's success was that wherever he conquered, he also built. He constructed irrigation channels and cultivated terraces in every territory he expanded into. During his reign, the Inca road system expanded dramatically, until it stretched more than 5,000 kilometers from Ecuador to Chile, allowing the army to travel quickly to wherever it was needed. Pachacuti understood the importance of intelligence and relied heavily on a network of spies and informants who would infiltrate neighboring states and bring back reports on their power and wealth. Pedro Cieza de León, a Spanish Jewish conquistador who collected Inca recollections, describes how this king would attempt to win over the rulers of these kingdoms. They always arranged matters so that things should be pleasantly and not harshly ordered. They marched from Cusco with their army and warlike materials until they were near the region they intended to conquer. Then they collected very complete information touching the power of the enemy. The Inca sent special messengers to the enemy to say that he desired to have them as allies and relations, so that with joyful hearts and willing minds, they ought to come forth to receive him in their province and give him obedience, as in other provinces, and that they might do this of their own accord. He sent presents to the native chiefs. Most of the neighboring rulers seemed to have accepted and were peacefully folded into the empire. But the offer wasn't without an implicit threat. Refusal to accept Inca rule resulted in an invasion, and rulers who resisted were executed without exception. The Inca army at this time was a powerful force. The Inca and other Andean cultures had the most advanced metallurgy of the American continents, and made tools and weapons from copper and bronze. Their weapons were spears launched using spear throwers, arrows and javelins, slings, as well as clubs and maces made from the hard black wood of the chonta palm, with blunt or spiked metal heads. Any commoner could be conscripted as part of the system of organized labor, and at times the army could exceed 140,000 men. The Inca had no iron or steel, and no real technological advantage over other Andean cultures, so they often relied simply on sheer force of numbers to overwhelm their opponents. This huge army would march into battle to the beating of drums, the blowing of trumpets made of wood, conch shells, or horn, and it's not hard to see why many Andean kingdoms elected to bend the knee rather than face it in battle. The logistical network that supported this army was no less impressive. Inca soldiers marched along immaculately maintained highways through the mountains, lined with barrack-like shelters called tambos, and fed from the well-supplied storehouses. Throughout all the royal roads, writes Cieza de Leon, there were built from half-league to half-league small houses, well-roofed with wood and straw, that lined the roads at regular intervals. Thanks to these highways, the Inca army was able to move faster, gain speedier information, and amass a greater force than any of their rivals. Once the Inca had taken control of a town, whether peacefully or by force, they would always build a large fortified storehouse called a culca. These high storehouses were always built high up the valley sides to take advantage of the mountain winds to keep food dry. But they also acted as a highly visible symbol to the people in the valleys below. In one region alone, there were nearly 3,000 of these storehouses, with a combined capacity of 170,000 cubic meters, or nearly 70 Olympic-sized swimming pools. These the Inca would fill with food, naturally freeze-dried potatoes and corn, beans, dried meats, and other long-lasting foods, as well as clothing, blankets, and shawls, even sandals, which would then be distributed to the population. It would have been clear to everyone in the new Inca province which side their bread was now buttered. Religious belief in this region was incredibly diverse, and like the Romans, the Inca practiced an inclusive attitude that allowed them to incorporate a diverse range of people into their empire. In territories they conquered, local religions and cults were allowed to continue, and where possible were folded into the existing mythos of the Inca. When they conquered the people of Huarochirí province, for instance, they happily took on their god, Macahuisa, with an added mythos about how he had helped to defeat some rebellious peoples. Macahuisa reduced all those villages to eroded chasms by flashing lightning and pouring down more rain and washing them away in a mudslide, records the Huarochirí manuscript. From that time onward, the Inca revered Pariacaca even more and gave him 50 of their retainers. Of course, the Inca god Viracocha never lost his place at the top of this increasingly crowded pantheon. One of the most remarkable constructions of this period is the outpost that would one day be known as Machu Picchu, perched on a mountain ridge rising half a kilometer above the valley floor, with steep cliffs plunging down on either side. It's not clear exactly what this town was designed for. It was never self-sufficient and relied on constant supplies being ferried up to it from the rest of the empire, meaning that it must have had a specific purpose. Some believe it may have been a royal retreat chosen for the beauty of its location, while others argue that it was a plantation or trading post for coca leaves, a high-value crop that the Inca chewed and brewed into tea for medicinal purposes and for a mild narcotic effect. More than 100 steps of white granite connect the town's temples and houses, its water reservoirs, terraces, and its sun temple. It must have been a magnificent sight, with its thatched rooftops gleaming bright in the sun, while herds of llama trekked up the narrow mountain roads to to supply it with the necessities of life, and the clouds rolled over its grassy slopes. Inca was the Quechua word for lord, and around this time it began to refer to the empire's ruling ethnic group too. The king who reigned in Cusco was now known as the Sapa Inca, or the lord without equal. By the end of the reign of Pachacuti, the city of Cusco had become the heart of an entity known as Tahuantinsuyu. In Quechua, this means four regions together, and has been translated as something like the land of the four quarters. This was now a stable imperial state, ruling over four provincial governments with strong leaders: Chinchasuyu in the northwest, Antisuyu in the northeast, Kuntisuyu in the southwest, and Kulasuyu in the southeast. The roads leading to each of these four provinces all met at a crossroads in the central plaza of the city of Cusco, where the babble of dozens of languages would have been heard on the streets. The imperial capital of Cusco was a strange city. There were no markets or squares, no workshops or places of business. Foreigners and commoners were forbidden to stay in the city overnight, and it was home purely to the temples and priests, as well as the king in his palace. On the hill overlooking Cusco, the Inca built a powerful fortress named Sacsayhuaman, a citadel of zigzagging stone walls built from enormous blocks of andesite. At the heart of this forbidden city was the no less impressive Coricancha, or Golden Enclosure, which the Spanish would later refer to as the Temple of the Sun. This was the spiritual and ceremonial heart of the empire. Cieza de León recounted the magnificence of the Coricancha's appearance, based on the evidence given to him by Cusco's surviving Inca princes and the few remaining eyewitnesses who had seen the temple in its glory days. The stone is somewhat black in color, rough yet excellently cut. There are many doors, and their arches are of a fine construction. At mid-height of the walls runs a band of gold, of some 17 inches in width and 2 in depth. The doors and arches are also embossed with sheets of this metal. In one of these houses, the grandest of all, was the figure of the sun, of great size and made of gold, and encased with precious stones. From its seat at Cusco, the Inca Empire would grow to become truly vast. At around 2 million square kilometers at its height, it was about the size of the Western Roman Empire. It was nearly 10 times the size of its nearest American rival, the Aztec Empire, and ruled over twice the number of people, up to 12 million. The Inca domain stretched from north to south for around 4,000 kilometers, or a tenth of the way around the globe. The Inca were deeply suspicious of the Amazon to the east, and the cloud forest foothills that descend into it, known as the Eyebrow of the Jungle. In Quechua, they called this region Rupa Rupa, meaning hot, hot. And while the Inca tended to keep well clear of the rainforest's shady depths, they were clearly fascinated by the place. The jaguars, snakes, and tropical birds of the jungle appear constantly in Inca art. These forests were a source of brightly colored feathers that the Inca wove into their clothing for decoration, and they were also where widely traded luxury crops like tobacco and coca plants could be grown. The Inca economy is one of the most intriguing aspects of their society. Andean cultures had always exhibited a large amount of reciprocity, since the rugged landscape demanded large amounts of people come together to cut stone, dig channels and aqueducts in the rock, or build houses. And this led to a remarkably communalized labor system. To the extent that we can fit its structure into modern definitions, many have described it as an example of state socialism or even communism. As far as we can tell, the idea of private property didn't exist in Inca society, and they progressed on the basis of shared ownership of assets resources and the means of production. When an Inca couple got married, they were given a house and a plot of land by the state, which they would use to produce enough food for themselves. The state provided seeds and tools, as well as a pair of llamas for transportation, wool, and manure. In return, the family would give any surplus to the common storehouse, and they would agree to perform a public service known as mitta whenever called upon, perhaps to labor on a construction project for part of the year, or work in a particular workshop, making cloth or pottery, work as a message runner, or to fight in the army. Other than food and water, cloth was perhaps the most important resource in the Andes. For clothing and containers to store food, Andean society required millions of meters of thread, the bulk of which was made by women, who would have gone about the streets with their drop spindles, devices that allowed them to spin while walking around and taking care of their other duties. While the system had socialist aspects, it was certainly not an egalitarian paradise, and nobles and officials with more than 100 subordinates were exempt from the labor tax. The hierarchy of society was rigidly enforced, and peasants had little power. The authorities even conducted inspections of people's houses to ensure that commoners did not own any gold or silver, have any valuable clothing, or keep more than 10 animals. This entire system of organized labor was centrally planned from Cusco, and quite remarkably, operated without a single word ever being written down. The Inca never developed a written language, and so kept no written records, but they recorded information in a remarkable system known as quipu. This used rope knots of different sizes, positions, and colors to represent different information, and could be decoded by people initiated in this art, who were known as a quipu camayoc. They count by certain knots on cords, and so record what each chief has brought, wrote one early eyewitness, Hernando Pizarro. When they had to bring us loads of fuel, maize, chicha, or meat, they took off knots or made knots on some other part, so that those who have charge of the stores keep an exact amount. All the information on how many taxpayers there were, who had been born and died, the number of able-bodied men available for military service, the quantities of cloth and food and animals, all this was recorded in the quipu, and with a kind of counting table known as a yupana. They count on boards. They count by numbers from 100,000, 10,000, 100, 10, until they reach 1, wrote the indigenous historian Felipe Guaman Poma de Ayala. They keep track of everything that happens in this kingdom, celebrations, Sundays, months and years. In each city, town and village of Indians, there were accountants and treasurers. It has also been speculated that the quipu may have been used as a memory aid to help in the recitation of epic poetry, but we may never know, as the system has never been deciphered in modern times, and the knowledge of how to interpret the quipu has been lost. With its sprawling territory, its well-oiled, centrally coordinated economy, and its state-of-the-art road network, by the turn of the 16th century, the Inca Empire was at the height of its power and confidence. But events were brewing in the wider world that would soon bring them into contact with powers far outside their past experience, and which would ultimately lead to the wholesale collapse and disintegration of their society. The name of the Inca Emperor Huayna Capac meant the young mighty one. He had come to power at the age of 25 in 1493. Just 1 year earlier, Christopher Columbus had first set foot in the Caribbean and was at that time back in Europe, preparing for his second voyage. Emperor Huayna Capac was a conqueror by nature. During the nearly 3 decades of his long reign, the Inca army was constantly on the move, and the empire doubled in size, expanding into present-day Chile and Argentina. For much of his reign, he was hell-bent on subjugating the tropical northern territory of what is now Ecuador and Colombia, where tribal peoples had long resisted Inca expansion. These wars in the jungle were a bitter quagmire. The terrain was difficult, and the Inca soldiers were not used to the climate. During this time, constant warfare must have become a daily fact of life in the empire. In the year 1515, while staying in his northern capital of Tumipampa and preparing for another campaign, Huayna Capac heard rumors of some unusual strangers who had arrived by boat. News reached him that some strange people of a type that was quite unknown were cruising in a ship along the coasts of his empire and had wanted to know what country this was, remembers the chronicler Inca Garcilaso de la Vega. This naturally aroused the entire attention of the king, who immediately made inquiries as to who these people were and from where they came. Huayna Capac was deeply troubled by this appearance. He surrounded himself with a permanently powerful army, chosen among the veterans of his conquests, and he had countless offerings and sacrifices made to the sun. But the strangers had left, and no further word was heard from them. 3 or 4 years having passed and no disturbing events having occurred, people grew less anxious, and little by little, the empire recovered its former calm, writes de la Vega. When the city of Tenochtitlan was besieged and destroyed far away in Mexico in 1521, Huayna Capac was 28 years into his reign. By then, he may have all but forgotten about that disturbing appearance of those foreigners 6 years earlier. But still, there were troubling rumors coming from the north. Rumors of a wave of destruction passing over the land. Whole villages were being wiped out, laid low by some mysterious plague. Perhaps Huayna Capac dismissed these rumors at first. That is, until he developed a fever, the likes of which the Inca had never encountered before. One day, as Huayna Capac was coming out of a lake in which he had just bathed near Quito, writes the chronicler, he was suddenly seized with a sensation of chill, which was followed by one of intense heat. This was likely smallpox, which struck some indigenous Americans with such speed that they never developed pustules. His condition rapidly deteriorated, and in 1527, the Sapa Inca Huayna Capac died in the north, more than 1,000 miles from home. On his deathbed, he is supposed to have uttered a prophecy of doom. Our Father the Sun has revealed to me that after the reign of 12 Incas, his own children, there will appear in our country an unknown race of men who will subdue our empire. I think that the people who came recently to our own shores are the ones referred to. These people will return shortly after I have left you, and that they will accomplish what our Father the Sun predicted they would. Whether or not these were actually his dying words, they certainly show the apocalyptic mood that would soon sink in among the snowy peaks and deep valleys of the Andes Mountains. Within a few weeks, the emperor's mummified body began its 2,000-kilometer journey south to Cusco. His lords carried him on a throne, bound tightly in white cloth. The procession traveled on the great Chinchasuyo Road that separated the coastal plains and the towering mountains above. A caravan of lords and warriors, porters and lamas, slowly climbing up through the terraced roads and canyon valleys. When the emperor's retinue arrived in Cusco, they found the city devastated. While they had been away, the plague had reached the capital and killed countless citizens, along with many lords and officials. The Incas' sophisticated road system, one great engine of their progress, had now become a conduit for disease. Bodies must have piled up in the streets, with hardly enough people left to carry them away. Before the people of the Andes had even set eyes on a European, the contact of the two worlds had unleashed chaos. On his deathbed, Huayna Capac had named his oldest son his successor. But before this prince could take the throne, he died of the same disease that had killed his father. With no clear successor, the empire now teetered on the brink of civil war. In the traditional capital of Cusco, one of Huayna Capac's sons, called Huascar, declared himself the rightful ruler. But in the rebellious northern region of Quito, another of his sons was in charge of a sizable army. That man's name was Atahualpa. Atahualpa was a man of some 30 years of age, wrote the chronicler Francisco López de Jerez. Of fine appearance and disposition, somewhat stocky, his face imposing, beautiful and ferocious, his eyes bloodshot. He was a tenacious battlefield commander, whose troops had been hardened by long years fighting his father's jungle war in the north. Warlike, ambitious, and daring, writes the historian W.H. Prescott, he was constantly engaged in enterprises for the enlargement of his own territory. His restless spirit excited some alarm at the court of Cusco. It wasn't long before Atahualpa defied his brother Huascar's claim to the throne and declared himself ruler of the north. For 2 years, both brothers eyed each other suspiciously across their borders. But in 1529, war broke out, and Atahualpa marched south to seize the entire empire for himself. The civil war that followed lasted for 3 years. During this time, Spanish sources portray Atahualpa as ruthless in the prosecution of his campaign. Juan de Betanzos, who was married to an Inca princess, wrote that Atahualpa buried some rebel chiefs alive, while with others, he ordered that their hearts be pulled out while they were alive. He said he wanted to see the color of the hearts of evil men. In 1532, Atahualpa forced his brother back to his final stronghold of Cusco, before finally defeating him. He imprisoned Huascar and purged any members of the royal court who may have had stronger claims to the throne than his own. His victory was total. Atahualpa was now well on his way to becoming the 13th Sapa Inca, the next in a line of kings that stretched back 100 years to the reign of Pachacuti. His land may have lain in ruins. His people may have been ravaged by disease and war, but the entire world now seemed to bow down before him. Playing opposite Atahualpa in this drama is a man named Francisco Pizarro. Pizarro was born in 1478 in Extremadura in southeastern Spain, then part of the Kingdom of Castile. There is no official record of Pizarro's birth, suggesting that he may have been illegitimate, and he began his life herding pigs in the dusty town of Trujillo. After an early career as a mercenary, in 1502 he sailed to Hispaniola, where he earned a considerable fortune as a slaver, plantation owner, and trader. In the New World, Pizarro achieved a wealth and status that would have been impossible in Spain, where the entrenched class system would have always treated him as a peasant. He seems to have fostered no desire to ever return to his homeland, and instead spent his days surrounded by all the trappings of wealth in the New World. Still, Pizarro dreamed of one day making his name as an adventurer. In 1513, he joined the explorer Vasco Núñez de Balboa and sailed to modern-day Panama. The Spaniards didn't know it yet, but this was the thinnest point of the American landmass, where only 50 kilometers of land separates the Atlantic Ocean from the Pacific. It's at this crossing point between the oceans that the destiny of Pizarro and the fate of the Inca would be sealed. Balboa and Pizarro set about the settlement of Panama with the usual destruction and enslavement of indigenous people that accompanied all European settlement in the New World. One local chief called Comogre decided to cooperate and offered to pay them off in gold and information. It was from him that the Spaniards first heard of the existence of another ocean to the west. "I am told that the other sea is very good for canoe navigation," Comogre told them, "for that it is always smooth and never rough like the sea on this side." In one version of events, Comogre's son, angry that the Spanish kept demanding gold, is said to have burst out, "If you are so hungry for gold that you leave your lands to cause strife in those of others, I shall show you a province where you can quell this hunger." Legends of a mythical city of gold lying just beyond the horizon were a common motif in the Spanish exploration and settlement of the Americas, and it's not hard to see how this piece of folklore emerged. Whenever local people discovered the Spanish obsession with the precious metal, they would often assure them that there was plenty of gold just over the next hill, if only they would pack up and leave them in peace. We don't know whether Comogre and his son really knew about the Inca and their temples of gold high in the Andes, or whether they were just trying to make the Spanish move on. But the result was the same. Balboa organized an expedition to cross the Isthmus of Panama and reached what he called the Other Sea. Pizarro was made a captain of this expedition, which hacked its way through the jungle, the conquistadors boiling in their armor, beset by mosquitoes and flies. Finally, they heard the sound of waves and crested a low rise to see a beach, and beyond it a boundless blue ocean stretching to the horizon. They had arrived at the cutting edge of the continental plate that for the last 150 million years had been forging westwards into the Pacific, and Balboa would be remembered as the first native of the Old World to reach it. But the life of a conquistador was violent and pitiless. Pizarro had been Balboa's friend for many years, but when the opportunity came to betray him in the years that followed, he didn't hesitate. In one of the routine power struggles that took place here at the edge of the world, Pizarro was ordered to arrest Balboa by his rival, the governor of Panama, and the explorer was later executed. For his services in this matter, Pizarro was given a swampy bit of land to call his own, and this is where he might have stayed for the remainder of his life. That is, if it wasn't for the news that would soon come trickling down the coast from Mexico, of the incredible exploits of one of his distant cousins, a fellow Castilian Spaniard named Hernán Cortés. At this time, Cortés was considered a hero in the Castilian court, his fall from grace some way in the future. And with the printing of two of his letters in Seville in 1522 and 1523, his conquest of Tenochtitlan would become legendary. Cortés was 7 years younger than Pizarro, and through his mother, he was his second cousin once removed. Pizarro openly admired his overachieving relative and must have dreamed of emulating some of his success. Both Cortés and Pizarro had grown up in Extremadura, and both had set sail to explore the New World, living in Hispaniola at the same time. But there, the similarities end. Cortés had had a legal education and worked as a notary and treasurer. While we may not always trust his account of events, the five letters he wrote during the conquest of Mexico speak to us out of history with a commanding voice, explaining his motivations, his desires and his fears, replete with biblical quotations and classical allusions. Pizarro is more of an enigma. He was born to a poor family and could neither read nor write. For this reason, We learn of him and his motivations only through those who accompanied him. The fame and wealth that Cortés won for himself in Mexico reignited Pizarro's lust for adventure. By this time, he was in middle age. He was tall and spare, having a good face and a thin beard, wrote another of his cousins, Pedro Pizarro. It was his custom, whenever anyone asked him for anything, always to say no, in order that he might not fail to keep his word. And though he said no, he always did in the end what was asked of him, if there were not reason against it. Pizarro joined a company heading along Panama's Pacific coast, determined to find out the truth about the rumored cities of gold that were supposed to lie to the south. While Cortés's expedition had been a relatively amateur affair, with few professional soldiers, Pizarro's was even more of a rough bunch. He had about 100 men, none of them soldiers, and many of whom had signed up to escape debts or avoid jail time. They had enough money for only 2 ships, and they set sail in November 1524. The expedition crept along the coast for more than a year, dogged by bad weather and worse luck. Running out of supplies, the men were forced to eat raw shellfish and wild berries that made them ill. But then, in 1526, they came across something they had never seen before in the Americas. A native boat with a sail. Drawing nearer, they found a raft carrying 20 indigenous people, as well as a variety of jewelry and cloth, belts, necklaces, and pins of gold and silver, inlaid with gems. The sailors' clothes were finely embroidered, decorated with patterns of birds, flowers, and animals. When the Spaniards asked greedily where these goods came from, they were told that it had all come from a wealthy land called Peru that lay to the south. The news lit a fire under Pizarro, but his men were tired of the expedition, and the governor of Panama had ordered them home. Nevertheless, Pizarro shared something of Cortés's passion for dramatics, and in this instance, his words passed into legend and idiom. He drew a line in the sand with his sword and announced, "Friends and comrades, on that side are toil, hunger, nakedness, the drenching storm, desertion and death. On this side, ease and pleasure. There lies Peru with all its riches. Here, Panama and its poverty. Choose each man what best becomes a brave Spaniard. For my part, I go south." Most of Pizarro's men were not won over by this piece of oratory. Only 13 of them stepped over the line in the sand, but it was enough for his journey to continue. In 1528, Pizarro and his skeleton crew reached the Inca town of Tumbes, today located on the border between Ecuador and Peru. Here, finally, was evidence of the wealthy empire they had been promised. Tumbes was a thriving port city and hub of the salt trade, with a strong fortress and a fine temple, well supplied with water from several aqueducts that fed into fountains and public baths. The people of Tumbes received Pizarro and his men politely, and sent out balsa rafts with food for the new arrivals. "When the natives of the mainland saw the ship approaching on the sea," writes Cieza de Leon, "they were astounded because they were seeing something they had never seen or heard about." The people of Tumbes even gave Pizarro 2 boys, who he took with him back to Panama and taught to speak Spanish. These he would use as translators throughout the following years. Cieza de Leon writes that the people of Tumbes dispatched a messenger to the Inca king Huayna Capac, informing him of the Spaniards' arrival. But they say that when the news arrived, Huayna Capac was already dead. Encouraged and reeling from his discovery, Pizarro sailed further up the coast, and everywhere he saw small towns and picturesque coastal hamlets where the people told him that they were part of a great empire, whose glittering gold capital lay far up in the high mountains. Pizarro saw the enormous networks of aqueducts that made even the coastal deserts bloom, and the well-maintained roads linking the settlements, and felt that he had evidence enough to confirm the rumors. But his tiny force had no hope of making anything of it. He returned to Panama and prepared for another voyage. The arrival of the Spanish at Tumbes caused a ripple of consternation in the Inca lands, already in the throes of civil war and racked by plague. After Huayna Capac had died, people scrambled for political power, records the Huarochirí manuscript, each saying to the others, "Me first, me first." It was while they were carrying on this way that the Spanish lords appeared. One later Inca ruler named Taitu Cusi, who had been a boy at the time of the invasion, recounted his memories of that time to a Spanish missionary. In the resulting document, looking back from a distance of 40 years, Taitu Cusi relates the words of his father, one of Atahualpa's brothers, as he hears about the Spanish arrival. "How dare these people intrude into my country without authorization and permission? Who are these people and what are their ways?" The messengers answered, "Lord, they claim to have come by the wind. They are bearded people, very beautiful and white. They eat out of silver plates. Even their sheep who carry them are large and wear silver shoes." Taitu Cusi even captures what it was like to see the Spaniards reading for the first time. "We have witnessed with our own eyes that they talk to white cloths by themselves, and that they call some of us by our names without having been informed by anyone and only looking into the sheets which they hold in front of them." As in the conquest of Mexico, Inca sources recall the appearance of portents before the arrival of the Spaniards. An eagle had been attacked by condors above the main square of Cusco, and many had reported seeing a blood-red circle enveloping the moon. There followed earthquakes of such unusual violence that great rocks were shattered in pieces and mountains collapsed, attests Inca Garcilaso de la Vega. "The sea became furious, overflowed its shores, invading the land, while numerous comets streaked the heavens, sowing terror in their wake." No one knew what the arrival of the foreigners could mean. When Pizarro arrived back in Panama, many were astonished, having assumed his expedition lost at sea. But no one was particularly interested in his discoveries, and the governor of Panama refused him permission for any more expeditions. Pizarro was frustrated. The temptation of the faraway empire, along with all its gold and glory, began to possess him. We can imagine him lying awake at night in the hot Panama air, listening to the whining of mosquitoes overhead and the cackling of spider monkeys in the trees outside his cabin, all the while thinking about the glory and gold that might await him, far away on the shores of the other sea. In 1528, he decided to sail back home for the first time, with the intention of gaining an audience with the most powerful man in Europe, the King of Spain, Archduke of Austria, and Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, and his Queen Isabella. When he stepped off the ship, Pizarro must have found Spain much changed. He had left it as a wealthy late medieval kingdom, but in the last three decades, the newly united state had become the bustling hub of a colonial empire. Its ports had swollen with the wealth coming in on its treasure ships, and now enormous 1,000-ton galleons carrying hundreds of cannons would have towered over the roofs. By then used to frontier life, he must have found the opulence of the royal court in Toledo staggering. Pizarro managed to secure an audience, perhaps helped by the presence of his then-popular cousin Cortez at court, and when he came before the royal couple, he offered up gold and jewels, exotic birds and embroidered cloth, even the fleece of a llama, along with a newly drawn map of Peru. Charles and Isabella must have looked at these treasures hungrily. The capture of Mexico only 8 years before and the establishment of the colony of New Spain had brought them enormous riches, as now this commoner was offering to conquer another indigenous empire and bring back perhaps even more treasure. On the 26th of July, 1529, Queen Isabella signed a charter called the Capitulación de Toledo, authorizing Pizarro to invade Peru. To conquer, discover, pacify, and populate the coast of the South Sea of said land. Without the Inca having the slightest knowledge of it, with the stroke of a pen 10,000 kilometers away, their land had been renamed New Castile, and Pizarro had been named its governor. The queen also made Pizarro a knight of the Order of Santiago, Spain's highest order of merit, and gave him several Dominican friars to take with him to underscore the notion that he was on a religious mission. They gave him provisions to buy artillery in Panama, 25 horses from Jamaica, and 30 African slaves. But other than this, the monarchy offered no direct financial support. For the crown, Pizarro's expedition was low risk and potentially very high reward. By January 1530, Pizarro had returned to Panama and prepared his expedition. He brought with him as an assistant his 15-year-old cousin Pedro, who would later write one of the most important eyewitness accounts of the invasion. Pizarro had his usual run of bad luck on the voyage. Strong headwinds blowing up the Pacific coast stopped his progress for nearly 2 weeks, and storms ravaged the ships. Still, he must have been barely able to contain himself as they sailed past Colombia and Ecuador, sharing tales of the bustling town of Tumbes that awaited them. But when they finally sighted Tumbes, Pizarro was astonished to find the city abandoned, a ghost town. "The town of Tumbes was destroyed," wrote the conquistador Francisco López de Jerez. "It seemed to have been an important place, judging from some edifices it contained. The natives say that these edifices were abandoned by reason of a great pestilence and by reason of the war." Pizarro was distraught. He made camp in the ruins and lingered there for a few months, trying to gather information about what had happened from some locals hiding nearby. The people of Tumbes were now frightened and suspicious, and when some local chiefs plotted to attack his men, Pizarro had them burned alive. Soon, terror of the newcomers spread among the nearby peoples. Over the course of his conquest of Peru, Pizarro, like Cortez, used these terror tactics constantly and burned dozens, perhaps hundreds, of local chiefs. Pizarro must have known that his situation was precarious, and his soldiers expected more than to simply set up camp in the ashen ruins of Tumbes. Soon, his promises of gold would have to be fulfilled. Finally, he resolved to march up into the hills and find this fabled city of gold. Pizarro set out on the 16th of May, 1532, with a company of 187 men, made up of 102 foot soldiers, 62 horsemen, 3 artillery operators with cannons, and 20 crossbowmen. Ahead of them lay a journey of more than 2,000 kilometers across deserts and over snow-capped mountains.